Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, October 19th, 2006. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week we head to Fort Collins, Colorado to talk to two people who are instrumental in making beers at New Belgium Brewing. Eric Salazar and his wife Lauren are responsible for the blending of the wonderful La Folie, which if you listen to the show, you know that's one of my favorite beers. We'll talk to Eric. And Peter Buchart is the brewmaster at New Belgium. We'll sip beers as we chat with Peter in the beautiful brew house, too. We've got a lot of interview to squeeze into under an hour, so I want to get to it. But first, I want to let you know that the Basic Brewing baseball caps are now available in our online store. You can choose from three different logos, the Basic Brewing logo, the Basic Brewing radio logo, or the Basic Brewing video logo. It'll be interesting to see which hats move the fastest. Right now, the Basic Brewing video hat is in the lead. So go to basicbrewing.com and look in the apparel section of our shop, and they're in there along with shirts. Also, be sure to check out this week's Basic Brewing video. We have our video interview with Charlie Papazian. Now, this is a different interview with Charlie from what you've heard on this program on the audio side. We chat with Charlie in his living room. And we also get to tour his home brewery, so you get to see where Charlie Papazian makes his beer. Now, when Andy Sparks and I traveled to Colorado for the Great American Beer Festival, we scheduled a few days ahead of time to tour some of the area's breweries. And one of those at the top of our wish list was New Belgium, and we were not disappointed. In addition to the wonderful interviews you'll hear today, we were treated to an extensive tour of their operations, including a place or two that the usual tour doesn't go. And you can see that on an upcoming episode of Basic Brewing Video. So again, we're taking you places that you don't have an opportunity to go on our programs. Joining Andy and me on our Fort Collins trip was John Holder, who you may remember you've heard on this show in connection with the hot side aeration experiment with Brian Warren. We appreciate John's help in navigating and in helping to ask some insightful questions. Now, first of all, let's listen to our interview with Eric Salazar. You heard Eric's wife, Lauren, this past week. She was on the judging demonstration panel that they put on. Eric started out on the bottling line at New Belgium 11 years ago, and his responsibilities have grown ever since. He's now the brew house and cellar operations cooperative owner.
La Folie was something that Peter Buchart essentially started years ago, and the whole thing really comes from, it's his brainchild, it comes from his whole idea, and what he's done is started it and then pass it on to my wife and I, Lauren Salazar, and now essentially what we do is we're kind of the caretakers of the wood fooders back there. Lauren's largely in charge of tasting them. She's all in charge of blending them and tells me what to blend. I'm kind of the muscle behind it, where she's kind of the brains. We'll sit down in a room and we'll go through all the fooders and we'll taste them each at a time, one at a time, decide what the taste profile should be for this brown La Folie, and then we'll go ahead and start mixing them little by little. We'll decide which percentages of which fooders we want. It usually turns out to be about three fooders blended into one batch of La Folie. And so La Folie works. You can't taste it 6 months ahead of time and expect to blend it 6 months later, because it's going to change in each fooder. So you really have to taste it right before you blend it and right before you bottle it. So every 6 months or so, I get to sit down with my wife, taste a whole round of wood beer, and then decide which ones we're going to blend, and then she's the brains. I'm kind of the muscle. I go back there, drag hoses around, get out all the pumps, do all the blending, all the filtering, and then we all bottle it by hand here with help from everybody at the brewery.
Holy smokes. Now, that it's got to be a labor of love.
It definitely is. It really is. When it's time to do the La Folie, what it really means to me is 10 to 15 hour days for a week solid. So I kind of go into it thinking about that, but really, when it comes down to it, it's not that hard to spend that much time here blending La Folie, because when the finished product comes out, it's exactly how I want it to be. It's usually, you know, precisely what we were thinking, and I love it. It's one of my personal favorites, so it's not that hard to be at work that long.
For those who haven't tried it, talk a bit about the style, the character, what you're shooting for, the flavors you're getting, just a background on the beer itself.
Okay. So the style itself, it could officially be called sour brown. So really, it's a sour beer. It's a brown beer. We want a lot of wood flavors. We want some tannins to be in there. A slight bit of acetic, but you don't want too much. You also want to have a little bit of fruitiness. How we normally do it is we'll take a younger beer, which is normally a lot sweeter than the older beer, say a beer that's eight months old to one year, and then we'll blend that with a couple of other beers that maybe are 2 years old. With the older beers, you get more sour. With the younger beers, you get more sweet. And if you blend those to taste, you can have a fine balance in there. So really what you're tasting is a two-year-old, at its oldest, sour beer that imparts a lot of oak flavors that we've taken time to cultivate over the years.
Now, homebrewers out there are going to, their question is, what's the recipe? So I know you may not want to share the keys to the castle, but can you give us a bit of a description of what goes into the Lafayette?
So essentially, if you want to do this yourself, you get some nice old wine oak, and you can introduce any flavors you want to. If you introduce some sour aspects into it, a good idea would be to take some sour beer, introduce it into the oak, and let it age for a while. Take any beer you like and put it into oak and let it age, and in 2 years, see what you have. If it doesn't taste good, then you've got to start over again. But, you know, it's a labor of love, like you say, and that's essentially how it goes. We really don't know what we're going to get for 2 years, you know.
So if you're a home brewer and you've got a few gallons waiting around for 2 years, and if it doesn't come out right, not that much loss. But on the commercial scale, there's a lot in your hands.
Well, you kind of expect to lose it, you know. Peter Bucart has always said, if you're not dumping a few hectoliters of beer, then you're not making good beer. And that's really a good rule of thumb, because not everything's going to turn out exactly how you want it to. With those big wood fruiters, what we can do is, if we let it age for a while, we can taste it throughout the process. We can pretty much say which direction it's going. If it's not going the right direction based on its flavor, then we know how to treat the cleaning of that tank. What really happens is, you're looking for diffusion of oxygen through the wood, and you'll get a lot of beer stone. So essentially, sometimes it might just be as simple as emptying it out, getting in there, scraping off the beer stone by hand and whatever else is built up on that wood, so you get the diffusion of oxygen through the wood, and then refilling it. You know, take the good with the bad, take some loss to create a lot of good. So
Lafayette is going to be with us for a while?
Lafayette is going to be, as long as I can control it, I hope so. I really love the beer, and I love making the beer. And I know, even around here, because when we bottle it, we have people from all over the brewery come down and help bottle it with us. So people really enjoy taking an entire Friday off and bottling Lafayette, because they get to sit down with people from all over the brewery who they might not normally talk to, and sip on some Lafayette all day while we hand cork it, hand label it, hand put it in boxes. And it's, you know, kind of a throwback to the old days. And then people, it's kind of a social thing as well. So, and the outcome is Lafayette.
Well, Eric, we appreciate your time, and we appreciate your hospitality.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
We appreciate Eric taking time to talk to us. Everyone we talked to at New Belgium was very helpful and welcoming, and it just looks like a really fun place to work. Now, Peter Bucart, New Belgium's brewmaster, is very passionate about brewing and doesn't have trouble speaking his mind. In fact, I kind of set him off in the beginning, but it was a conversation that we found engaging and inspiring at the same time, and I hope that you do too.
Well, Peter Bucart, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio, and we are sitting in, where are we, Peter?
We're sitting in what we call Brewhouse 2, our newest brewhouse that we built in 2002, I think. Should be on my plate, yeah, 2002.
And with us is John Holder.
Hello. Good to be here.
And Andy Sparks.
Hey, James. It's great to be here with you.
And we are going to try to pick your brains for the homebrewers that are listening out there, Peter, and how they can get the most out of this style of beer, the Belgian beers, since you do such a good job. Oh, you made a menacing move. What does that mean?
Do not mention the word style to me.
What do you mean by that?
I don't make styles, I make art. And it's up to you to qualify or classify it, but I'm the artist. I don't want to be talked about styles. So
that's excellent. That's excellent. And that pretty much goes in the Belgian tradition, does it not?
I kind of was struck coming here to the U.S. that the first thing people always ask about the beer, what style is it? And I really hate that question in the sense of, do you like it or don't you like it? It's kind of, people need to have a style to know if they're going to like it, or to fit it in their little brain, as we all have little brains, maybe. But come on, it's about, we're in an industry of 10 minutes of pleasure. And we're just creating something of 10 minutes of pleasure, and does it all need to be... Sorry, maybe I shouldn't go so deep in that, but it's really near and dear to me. I hate the word style. It's 10 minutes of pleasure, and it's a piece of art like that beer that we're drinking here. That's Eric's ale. From time to time, somebody in the brewery just gets to make whatever he wants, as long as it's physical possible. That's kind of the only requirement. And he came up with this beer, who's a blend between something really undrinkable that he brewed here, and he blended it with some of our wood-aged beer that we have. And he also added, get a percentage, but some peach. And so it's a sour peach beer, but what style is it? It's Eric's ale. It's his painting. He happens to paint that guy also, so that he made in beer.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because we have had guests on our show who say that styles are very important, and it's very important to brew to style, because the styles have evolved over time, and... You know, there's a reason that those styles have come into existence. So it's refreshing to hear you so adamantly speak on the other side of the fence.
And I was reading something this morning, and it was about a grandmaster, two or something, and three judging. And I was like, what the heck is that? So I Googled that, and I found the BCJ or something.
The BJCP.
And then if you look to their program, oh my, this really would kill me. That's like, but I need to nuance that a little bit in the sense of, I think what the GABF has done and a classification within the GABF has been instrumental for the brewing industry in the U.S. as it is now. Unfortunately, we're still referring to the old world as such, who I think is crap. An IPA in the U.S. is way better than an IPA in England. Why the heck should you still refer to that? But also, I think as an industry and maybe certain individuals within the brewing community really should get beyond that. Come on, move on. We have laid the foundation. We have educated our taste buds, our own taste buds. Now let's roll. Let's make fun things. And you see quite a bit of people doing that. And the GABF is following, and they create styles of Eric's peach sour things style like that, and they're following. Like La Folie, the first time won, there wasn't even a sour beer category, and the next year there was a sour beer category. So
you think it's the job of the brewers to push the envelope and to establish benchmarks that other people can live up to?
If you look to any piece of art or building, or what happens there? People are pushing the boundaries, and I thought people who push the boundaries a lot fail. And I think we, as brewers, we create a lot of crap also, but we're not going to do that twice, I hope. but a little bit of learning in the process as such. And so, out of it, there's going to be beautiful products that come out. And then they're going to get classified in a style. But by then, we're already way further again as brewers. The style, that's for the Michael Jacksons and the beer writers. And that's their problem. We are creating the 10 minutes of pleasure.
This kind of makes me think of a letter I got from a listener who said, I was making a beer. And I forgive me, I can't remember the style, but I was making a beer, and I guess it got infected because it's sour. And will the sourness go away, or what should I do with the beer? Is there any way to save it? And I said, well, I like sour beers. You might have made something that I would really enjoy. But I also said that you might want to save that beer and blend it with other beers that you make. And it sounds like that kind of goes along with your philosophy of brewing as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. The best inventions are sometimes made under pressure, like wars or something, but it's by people doing something unconscious, and it goes south, and some of those going south is actually a pretty interesting discovery. We were talking about Rash Apta, but if you see what boundaries he's playing on, it's excellent to see it. And I tasted some of his things, and there's good stuff in there, right? But you're pushing, continue to push the boundaries, and we should never, maybe except for brew pubs, because they need an identifiable product for customers that are not aware, but brewers that are positioned like a New Belgium or like there's other people around, we should never even listen to the voice of the customer. They do not know what they want next. They weren't asking for Fat Tire, they were not asking for La Folie, they were not asking for Abbey, they were not asking for... We just gave it to them, and they started drinking it.
So you are lucky, as a large brewery, who has a kind of a standard product in Fat Tire that is widely accepted, and you can kind of use that as maybe the linchpin of your business. Is that freeing as a brewer to have something like that, or is it limiting to be known for that? Are you seeing what I'm asking?
Yeah. I'm struggling a little bit with the answer on that one, in the sense of, it's of course freeing, because it's gonna make us capable of doing more. On the other side, I still blame Jeff that he ever made Fat Tire, because it's a damn difficult beer. It wasn't made to do what it does. It's a beer with no shelf life. It's a beer that doesn't age very well. But that was not the intention from Jeff. And we happen to be now in another environment with the same beer. And so... But it's of course like the Sierra Nevada, if you have, or in our case Fat Tire, or the Bovar Wheat, and it's good to have a horse where you can ride on. It creates definitely an added benefit. You see where we're sitting here in this beautiful brewhouse too. This wouldn't be here if we wouldn't have Fat Tire.
Yeah, so thank goodness for Fat Tire. but let's talk about home brewing, and give us some background. You said that you didn't start as a home brewer, but you kind of evolved along the way into doing some home brewing.
Home brewing in Belgium is not that popular, because we have pretty cheap and good beer in Belgium as such. And so I kind of stumbled in brewing from a study direction. I was in engineering, in biochemistry, but our university also had a direction specialization brewing and fermentation technology. So I stumbled upon that because I didn't want to do the small-scale stuff, and I kind of liked a product that you could embrace more. Then I started in brewing in Zolte and then in Rodenbach. In the Rodenbach, then I started home brewing. I actually did it with some used equipment from Rodenbach that we had. We didn't use some yeast vessels anymore, and that was actually pretty good shapes for home brewing. So we started doing that at a 30-liter scale. I don't know what was the pressing reason, but we stepped it up to 100 liters, who's for a home brewer already pretty big. We were still milling with a handmill. And our first 5 hectoliters, so that's like 4 barrel brew. We still were doing that hand melting. But we suddenly hit upon an opportunity from a guy who had a pretty nice room, who was decorated with old brewing equipment, Bois de l'eau, those wort coolers. The floor was all in wood from wooden vessels. And there were some filter tun bottoms built in that. So it was a very beautiful place. And he's like, I would like to make a brewery. And we're like, yeah, we don't have any money, but we know how to brew. And so we kind of started together making something. And we were just in the startup stage at the moment. New Belgium, our paths crossed, basically, say it as such. And since then, really, my wife says that her prefers me not to homebrew anymore, since kind of went totally out of hand.
Well, you're living the homebrewer's dream, you know. I think every homebrewer, and Andy's raising his hand, John's raising his hand, you know, once you make a few batches of beer, you're like, hey, this is what I want to do, and you're doing it. So give us your philosophy on, you consider yourself an artist, and I assume that you considered yourself an artist as a homebrewer as well. How did you approach, if you don't like styles, how did you approach formulating recipes? And, you know, give us some insight into your philosophy of that end of things.
Whew. How long do you want me to talk about that? Maybe I can use an example in the sense of I brew from time to time off-site in another brew pub or something, and I did something with Tommy Arthur in Pizza Port in San Diego. And my first question to him is, I didn't know how his system looks, so getting some information about the system is also always very crucial. You need to know what the system capabilities are for a producer, even as a homebrewer. I was pushing the boundaries. So what about spices? So what about Brettanomyces? And he's like, so what about lactobacilli? And he's like, so what about lactobacilli before boiling? He's like, okay. So what about acetobacter? And kind of just feeling the. And once I got that, I kind of made a recipe, more a concept. At that point, it's more about translating an idea on what I gave it to Tommy. I'm like, look, what do you think? And he made some correction based on his knowledge about his system. So we basically went for something where we did a pre-acidification. We got some wort of the first slaughtering, diluted it down to 10 Plato. Added a bunch of lactobacilli that I brought. I brought 2 liters of lactobacilli slurry that we had very densely propagated, poured it in. And so towards the end of boil, we actually we had a whole bucket sitting there with our lactobacilli. And that actually formed quite a bit of lactic acid. At the moment we were throwing it in, it tasted already pretty sour. But so, because he didn't want lactobacilli in his fermenters, we did it pre-acidification. And I did that because Brettanomyces, we fermented actually with, according to Tommy, Brettanomyces anomalous, if he's going to hear that, but I think it's still Brettanomyces brasiliensis, but okay, who cares? It's about flavor, it's about what tastes good. And Brettanomyces form ethyl lactate. And so that's why I wanted to have some lactic acid from those lactobacilli to have a substrate, something that that yeast could do something with, because if it doesn't have lactic acid, it cannot make it. So it needs to have something to combine it with. I didn't want the sourness from a taste threshold. I just wanted it from an ester formation stance. And so it's kind of paints the picture, I guess, on a recipe formulation. Can go a little bit wider, but maybe one crucial element. The Belgium Reinheitsgebot is relatively simple. There's only 3 ingredients, same like in the Germans. And the ingredients are experience, knowledge, and creativity. And any beer that you create should only exist out of those 3 ingredients. And you use them in different amounts, like you do anything, Then you have tools, eh? Then you have malt and hops and spices and grain and lactobacilli, brettanomyces, who cares at that point? But those are tools that you can use, but the ingredients are only those three: experience, knowledge, and creativity. And that's really deep in my philosophy about creating. So,
that's a wonderful philosophy. And you're going for more. You're going for something else. We're getting a refill. We're going from the Eric's Ale.
Pat Stout. Pat Stout is another beer. It's again the same process. One brewer, this guy works in the cellar, Patrick Murphy. And he wanted to make something. He wanted to make a stout in the middle of summer, but he wanted to make a stout as a Belgian would make a stout. And so that's his interpretation.
So how would you describe the character of this beer?
It's very dark if you have a look at it. But it does have some roasted, but it's not too roasted because if you taste most Belgian dark beers, they are not going to be very roasty in flavor. But then he wanted to do it with a yeast who kind of creates some aromatics also, who's not what you want in a stout. And so it has some isomalt acetate also, so the banana. And we wanted to add that to the whole picture as such. And I really think it's an interesting product as such also.
But you have to call it something, so you called it a stout, which is a style.
Yeah, but it's a Belgium stout, you know? A Belgium style stout.
Which is not a style.
Yeah, Andy says it's not a style, but now it is.
next year at the GABF, it'll probably be a style.
John, you had a question that you asked Eric earlier that he referred to Peter, so now's your chance.
Well, Peter, as a home brewer and as someone who's really enjoyed the art you produce, I've learned that I really enjoy sour in my beers. And through experimentation, I've played a little bit with dregs from a bottle of La Folie and things like that. But for a home brewer, there's not a lot of information outside of maybe the book Wild Brews. And even then, I feel like we're still playing with magic in some sense. How can I, as a home brewer, get the microorganisms I need to make a different sour characters? I mean, I don't even really know, because of a lack of experience, as you cited as one of the three important characteristics, what flavor profiles I get from the different things. And it, in a homebrew level, you know, it can be hard to isolate and get a hold of a single organism like that to play with.
Who cares about single organisms? if you lack knowledge or... there's two other actions, access here, and creativity then. And maybe most relevant for that is the way we started our wood project. And the first part is kind of very scientific, but then you're going to hear how hilarious it gets. In a sense, when we started it, I think, I forget how many microorganisms we have, but we had a bunch of brettanomyces that we sourced on things like the American type culture thing and so on. Sources that are inaccessible for the homebrew, but let me go to that. We first were testing them in a single organism jars, basically, homebrew scale, huh? And we were tasting them every week. And we kind of got totally, we did four different measurements on it, and I still have all those data. I should have thrown them away already a long time. Because what really got interesting was like, wow, now what if we combine this one and this one? And we started to do that on a glass level while we were tasting. But then we're like, why don't we make a growler from this? And really got very bored and tired about getting almost more data and data around it. And it's absolutely not a way that you should approach a project like that in microbiology, in brewing microbiology. They were like, okay, let's buy some oaken barrels. Again, not attainable for homebrewers, but again, if you look to Rice Upshaw's furniture test there that he did, there's a way, or plastic also has a penetrable amount of oxygen diffusion. But we started buying some wood, and we put all kinds of products on there. One was 12 volume percent, who was kind of an extraction of wood that we did. But then And we let it sit, and from time to time, when, and that's the crucial part for homebrewers, when we hit upon something. And you were talking about a homebrewer who had a sour beer. But you taste something in a bar that's sour. I actually, one of our best cultures that we probably have in our oaken barrels, that's a claim that I can't really prove since we don't really measure it or verify it. We really turned two barrels because we had a fat tire coming back who was completely sour. But they had no diacetyl. And we had it on taste panel, and so you need to rate it on taste panel. You're trained to sit up and shake hands, to rate it to a certain extent. And it's totally off for a fat tire. But my first question after a taste panel, where is that keg? I need to have that keg. And I took that keg, I went in the back where our wood cellar was, and I squirted it in two oaken barrels. But that's exactly what you need. This is a hop-sensitive lactobacilli that doesn't produce diacetyl. Oh. Can be more beautiful, even if it produced diacetyl. If you combine it with Bretta, and now come where we find Brettas, if you combine it with Bretta, that's going to take care of the diacetyl. Okay, so now we have a lactobacilli, and now let's search for some Brettas. A fun story on that one maybe is Chris Hartley from the Dollar Brewers. He had a keg who came back from Finland or something, where he hadn't sold beer for 6 years or something, and he had an empty bag keg returning. And he's like, I'm first going to inspect it before I'm going to clean it. And so he opens it up, and he's like, wow, that's an interesting smell. And so he collected whatever was left in there, and he grew that. And my homebrew method to grow things was I made a 10 grams per 100 gram sugar solution. And I added an egg, boiled it up, and that was my breeding ground because I don't have access to media, and I threw whatever I had in there, and that was my breeding ground. Because I don't have access to words like I have here, so that was intermediate. So he did that also. He just took that tank bottom that was smelling very well, and that's actually now his bottle condition yeast for those silver label bottles that he has.
Oh.
Yeah, but think about it. He found a nice Bretta in that way. Where can you find Bretta? Premium source or Val.
Uh-huh.
There's unfortunately, I don't know if there's still a Berliner Weiss who has Bretta. Most have been cleaned up. But our Beer de Mars,
which I have saved some of for that very reason.
Vinny in Russian River is playing with Brettas. Hey, but come on, there's brewers who are not professional brewers who are able to maintain those critters for you, eh? And those bottles can get old, eh? The Bretta will survive. There's proof. I met 2 or 3 months ago the professor from the VLB in Berlin, who did a research on 30 years old Berliner Weiss, and the only living organism that they found was Brettanomyces. But come on,
yeah.
Do you see your sources here? Acetic acid is another story. Yeah? If you want acetic acid, you don't want it, but that's relatively easy to get from vinegar. If you have a natural vinegar, you could use that. Eh? And those will form an ugly skin on your beer, but that's exactly what you want. Eh? That's what we want to see on our oaken barrels. That skin, who's an interference. And maybe you can ask a brewer who's doing some wood aging to get that beer. That's also, we brought back fresh lambic the day before we got on the plane and poured it in our oaken barrels. And it's really that, when I started this long answer here, you're going to have to cut here like hell.
No, not a word.
Who cares about single organisms?
Okay.
Yeah, as long as it tastes good.
Yes.
And especially something that is bitterness, and you have something that spoils a bitter beer, you're golden. That's what you need.
Yes.
Because most lactobacilli are going to die when the bitterness comes up if they're not used to it. Even, and that's the problem with my sugar solution with an egg boiled into it. If you don't have bitterness, you better add some hops if you want to, because it takes only one cycle for lactobacilli to get untrained, would that be the word, to be acting in wort, in hopped beer, sorry.
So your friends may be resting at the bottom of a bottle, Or if you have a happy accident like the home brewer that I talked about in the beginning, save that beer and play with it.
Go to a multi-tap on a Tuesday morning, multi-tap bar, and collect. Hey, Monday has been a slow day. There are no sports or something. Has been a slow day. It has been sitting overnight, and it's beautiful what grows into tap lines. But I would still do an isolation step, throw it in some wort that you have, and smell it, and kind of maybe pitch that to an extent. But that's hop, unsensitive microbiology that you're collecting there.
So in talking to Waj Apte again, it sounds like he enjoys finding these things that people are trying to keep out of their beers, because they are wild things that bring these elements to the beer that are unexpected. And I guess as an artist, having something unexpected happen can be a wonderful thing, right?
Of course. Hey, that's where the discovery is going to lay. If you think about the whole U.S. brewing, craft brewing scene right now, they have done very interesting things with malt. They have done very interesting with hops. They have done some things with yeast, and they haven't done anything, I'm exaggerating, on other stuff than yeast. And Brettanomyces is still within the yeast, but lactobacilli, gluconobacter, I've played with gluconobacter, a huge opportunity within there, but it's just new colors that we're discovering for our paintings, eh? And some of those colors, like the green from hops, has been already overexpressed in my eyes. And okay, we're gonna get some new varieties, but some people are gonna go, in my eyes, going totally overboard. And for me, it's still about balance. I still don't know a restaurant where they're gonna try to be like, look, this is gonna be the most sweet dish that you ever had. I see that in the brewing industry, and that's interesting. Those people are going to discover something, as long as they don't get stuck in their mindset, in my eyes. I don't want to name names on that one, but Elliot, just think creatively. And artists have their periods. They are in a period that they are discovering certain fields, but it's also building on their own experience and building on their friends' experience sometimes. And that's the beauty about the brewing community, and then the homebrewers community also. Think about it.
Yeah, I've thought often that if you get hoppier and hoppier and hoppier beers, at some point, at least the people who like those beers are going to become accustomed to that, and it's not going to be novel anymore, and it's just going to be the norm. And then how do you step out from that? So it sounds like you're thinking along those same lines, maybe?
No, I need to think. I don't think I ever will or have created a beer that's going to overexpress a certain leg to stand on. I'm always going to stand on multiple legs. And that's sometimes what I, in my eyes, blame to certain brewers who go so monodimensional. I played with kefir for a few beers, and kefir is really the example of a monodimensional flavor. It is that citrus-like flavor, and it's nothing else. And it's nice, but it's not nice if you leave it alone. And bitterness is nice, but it's not nice in my eyes. And I'm in Belgium, maybe, but it's not nice if you leave it alone. You need to build it around it, and whatever element that you want to express, you need to build it. And I like to build into pieces of architecture that nothing is going to stand out, but it's the whole that's going to be beautiful. The total picture needs to be beautiful, and that's for me key on what a beer should be. But okay, people can differ from opinion, and they will still be my friends.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I came into this interview hoping to get some, you know, kind of nuts and bolts tips on how to make better Belgian, I almost said the S word, beers, or, you know, some of the beers that you make. But we've come out, I think, with more of a philosophical approach on how to brew beers. And I think that that's just as important as knowing how to calculate IBUs or knowing how to calculate a grain bill or something like that is if you know just the nuts and bolts and you don't know how to think creatively, then I think that that you're crippling yourself.
Yeah. And that's an important part about the whole homebrewing thing is that you allow yourself to be creative, and since you're brewing on a small scale, you can make lots of small mistakes. You don't have to have costly mistakes. So you have the opportunity to play a lot and discover the art of homebrewing and not necessarily the science. You still have to know some of the science so that you can do it correctly and not make just idiotic mistakes, bad hygiene and stuff like that. But, you know, once you get the techniques down, then it's up to you to play and have fun and express yourself in your beers.
If you want to talk about, well, you're kind of asking a knowledge question, which is very typical for a homebrewer. But if you talk about the sour aspect of beers, to an extent, knowledge is relatively minimal there. And that's why I had quite some discussion with that internally here when I say that there's three ingredients. And knowledge and creativity kind of make sense, but experience. And I really wanted to add that experience axis because that's where, in my eyes, things like the sour beer is. It is not absolute, and I can talk about guidelines, but not about absolutes because I don't know. I really don't know. I know what I do, and things go south on me, but again, a good brewer, as a good home brewer, will always dump quite a bit. And so, and around those guidelines, if we drill a little bit into this, I'm thinking about how can I make that concise without having a picture. Let's talk about lactobacilli and acetobacter. And what can they do with our wort? Well, if you have wort who's on board, that's interesting. Maybe you have the Germans there with their, how do they call it, natural acidification, where they use unhopped wort. And we've done quite a bit of that also. The beer I made at Pizza Port also, that was a lactobacilli who was trained to work in unhopped wort. It was something that could not survive in hopped wort. It was a safeguard for Tommy, because I'm using an off-site brew house, so I don't want to affect his place. But so, the unhopped lactobacilli, and you can find those plenty if you go into the cheese making. There's a lot of lactobacilli in there. And those are not trained for hops. But you can throw them in unhopped wort and let them sit. And you can let them sit at temperatures, I don't know in Fahrenheit, but 37 to 45. There's actually tests. We did tests here until 48°C. And they go like hell, eh? We did one brew once, and in 14 hours, 4,000 ppm of lactic we made. And we only pitched it with two kegs in probably like 30 barrels of wort and 14 hours, but we kept it very warm. We did it in a mash tun so that we had heating capability. And from time to time we came in, but we just let it sit there and you could pre-acidify a wort. That's an opportunity. But if you look on the other side here, acetic acid bacteria, that's maybe not that interesting because those are going to form very fast quite some acetic acid on wort. If you can cut it off with boiling, that's interesting. But acetic acid is volatile, so you're probably going to strip it during boiling. Then that's what you can do in brew house. Then if you think about it later, you can work with mixed cultures, who's very interesting on his own, but very uncontrolled. I've done quite a bit of work on that. The beer that I made for the birth of our first son, and the beer in our home, in our brew pub, it was a mixed culture, and it was relatively heavily infected with lactobacilli, and it was basically collected over times and just kept at such. Propagation at that stage means that you just add wort. You're not going to add air, You just let it propagate itself. We threw that into some beers, but we made anything available, because it was a heavy infection, we did anything to reduce the effect of the lactobacilli. And we did that by hops, but not too high, 20 IBU, go relatively fast to a pretty decent alcohol content, and then ferment very fast and cool it down. Once you cool it down as a home brewer, the lactobacilli is not going to move too much.
A question, what does cool down mean for the effects of lactobacilli, temperature range-wise?
There's different things. Normally, literature talks about 15C, which is pretty warm, like 50 or so, 55, 50 Fahrenheit. But I would like to go colder. I like to put it in the fridge at that point. If you think it's fine, the diacetyl is gone, you have a nice lactic acid level, put it in the fridge, and as a home brewer, drink it from there. It's also a good source for future inoculation in the meantime. At that point, early in the fermentation, Acetobacter is kind of useless because the CO2 formation is going to make your fermentation pretty anaerobically, except if you could expose it pretty, if you open a wide-toed fermenter or something that's wide open. At that point, Acetobacter could be doing something, but not much. You could do a regular fermentation with yeast, and then you could bring in some of those microorganisms. I think I'm going where you wanted me to go. So if you throw in lactobacilli after that, but you need to worry a little bit about alcohol content, bitterness, CO2. Don't go too heavy on any of those so that your lactobacilli still can do something. You better add an easy nutrient source. So some sugar, but you better add something else like... what could you add? Maybe some grain that you boiled up a little bit or fried maybe in a pan and throw that in as a source of some nutrient, because lactobacilli needs kind of a complex medium, and grain is pretty good. Spent grain also would be good, actually. So you could throw in some, you heat your spent grain and throw it back in, and but you let it sit there again and let the lactobacilli go, whatever your source is, until you think it's decent and put it cold again. On the Acetobacter there, if you expose it to air, pretty interesting. I wouldn't do that alone. I would, at that point, anything I do at that point, I would always combine Acetobacter with Brettanomyces. Don't let it go alone. And those two can make a very nice layer on top of your beer, who's very stable in time. And so once you get that, use a growler, end of fermentation, leave it exposed to air, or if you have a source of Acetobacter somewhere in your fridge sitting, throw that in, add some Marval, and let that sit with some air. Maybe open it every two, or whenever you see it, open it once to give it a little bit of air, but not much. Lactobacilli with Bretta, okay, is a beautiful combination also. If you go further than that, wood is really not feasible, I think, for a homebrew stands, except if you buy a way too expensive small oaken barrel. But what Ryapta does with some micro, if you he basically puts a table leg into a growler for the oxygen diffusion, and he likes that because he can autoclave it or sterilize it. You can use some plastic also, or you could use a growler that you put on your side with a plastic cork or something to have some oxygen diffusion. You really don't need much for Acetobacter. You actually want to reduce the impact, I would guess, at that stage. And then it's some taste. You just taste. That's what we do for making La Folie. We're throwing it in there, and we let it sit, and we taste, and if we think it's decent... we bottle it up.
So I was going to say you're one of my new best friends because you've handed me a glass of La Folie. Is it challenging on the commercial side once you've got these wild animals and you've kind of you've tamed them to a certain extent? Is it challenging now that you've found something like La Folie that you like, that you want to keep the way it is? Now you've got to kind of hope that no other happy accidents happen to change the character of that beer.
Our big boss, Kim, made it pretty clear that my head is going to roll here when I affect the rest of the brewery. So. But if it, one of the big projects that we're currently working on, we call it other fermentations. And really what we're focusing on is that we're capable in some of our regular fermenters to produce beer that is not made with Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And that means physically those are just in the same room as our other fermenters are. But you should see the type of precautions we take around that. People say Brettanomyces is airborne. To me, that's partly blah, 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 but okay. You strip everything. If you have a heavy fermentation, you're going to, if you plate heavy fermentations with CO2, there's going to be all kinds of microorganisms in there just because they're stripped. Then on the other side, we're looking to any leaks, basically, like samples that people are taking for just tasting or lab analytical, need to be contained. Because it's a big challenge for us. And we definitely, I played with 100 cells per milliliter of Brettanomyces in all of our beers. Because it's a very good antioxidant, and I have an oxidation problem on fat tire. But at 100 cells per milliliter, it develops a Bretta flavor if you let it stand over a shelf life. And so it's a very potent flavor agent that you have here, and you need to deal with it as a very potent flavor agent. So,
well, I had one more question for you, in that it sounds like a good strategy for a homebrewer would be to try and get two or three of these things going, but then we have to figure out how we want to blend this to get a flavor. I mean, we have these colors now on our palate, but could you offer some tips perhaps on what we should do to try and make a blend that would be maybe just a starting point? It's obvious this is something that we have to play with, but you know, from zero experience, it would be nice to have a little bit of head start.
Maybe I can talk to you how the professionals do it. Huh? I'm going to talk to you about a session that we had on blending La Folie. And we actually had Frank Bon also in there. And we had Chris Black from The Falling Rock. And we basically have all our oaken barrels, who was at that point, we had a lot of smaller barrels. And we have made a pre-selection, and we're giving it for you to taste. And people are tasting it and taking notes and getting to the next one, getting to five. On a homebrewer scale, I really think you need to go there because you need to keep some of your product. If you make 5 gallons, why not keep a gallon and let it sit so they have a real good collection. And we're tasting a bunch, and after a while you see, that's Frank Bourne also, right? Who I would consider also a professional in that field. And you see people starting to combine this one with this one, and then you throw a little bit of this one in, and they're like, taste. And that's how we're doing it, really. We're just blending what we think could be potential with keeping track. We're professionals. Keeping track on what we blend. Sometimes we forget, but okay. But then people are starting to share. It's like, hey, this is number 8 with 30 and a little bit of 2. And people are like, oh, I did only 8 and 30. What do you think about this? And it starts to build, and that's really how we do it. There's real no magic behind it. There's only one thing that is a little bit difficult and requires some training, I would guess. We with La Folie, we're going to bottle conditioning. And so you need to be able to imagine what the bottle conditioning and especially the added CO2 is going to do to this product. But that's really the only thing that's going to change it still afterwards. And so,
I think from a homebrewer's point of view, I don't know if I speak for all, but I always taste my beers before I carbonate them. So I have a little practice with what the carbonation will do. But that seems like a good start, and it also sounds like a good way to have a run on the growlers at the homebrew shop so I can store off a little bit of all my beers.
Well, I have a good analytical capability here at New Belgium. We do not use anything for that. Not at all. And we're not going to use to bitterness. We're not going to use to lactic acid or acetic acid or ethyl acetate or ethyl lactate. We're just acting like homebrewers because a blend is a blend. And the individual analytical components are maybe interesting, but really from a blend stance, they're absolutely useless. I see that same doing. I did it with Frank Bowen and Bones also. And he has the analyticals also. And he looks at it. He's like, oh, that's interesting. And the ethyl lactate is a bit high on that. But from a practical blending stance, it really hasn't been much value.
Yeah, I was just going to point out that one of the things that I do as a homebrew shop owner is that I encourage the new homebrewers to taste their beer at every single step after the boil, after the primary fermentation, at the end of secondary fermentation, every step, you know, because that's part of what gives you that knowledge and education of how it all builds together in the layers of flavor. You know, you have to educate your palate.
I agree totally with you. I go sometimes a little bit deeper in flavors for me, for spices. For me, it's very important to know what spice components are really the part of the flavor in that spice, because boil or throughout the brew house or especially in fermentation with yeast contact, those flavors are going to change. And so I do maybe a little bit more scientific, but as a home brewer, well, throw that spice in and add yeast and see how it tastes before and after, kind of exactly what you're saying, because that flavor can be enhanced or it can be totally gone. And you need to know, and the only way to know it is by tasting it. So that's why the knowledge factor or the knowledge ingredient as such is very important in my eyes. But the experience ingredient is where really the beauty lays and where most of the creativity is going to lay also. So.
Well, Peter, we could sit here and listen to you talk and drink your beers all day, but I know that you've got to be somewhere. So I really appreciate your time today, and we are lucky enough in our part of the country to get your beers. And we appreciate your skill in brewing and everyone who works here at New Belgium. And thank you very much for having us here today.
Thank you.
We once again thank Peter and Eric and everybody else at New Belgium for being so open and generous with their time. We had a blast, drank some wonderful beers, and learned a lot. Now be sure to check out our upcoming video tour on Basic Brewing Video in the next few weeks. It was led by Chris McCombs, project coordinator at New Belgium, and we thank Chris for his time as well. Very helpful and a lot of fun. And thanks again to John Holder and Andy Sparks for their help and moral support. By the way, you can visit Andy's homebrew shop at thehomebrewery.com. That's thehomebrewery.com, and that's my local homebrew shop here in Northwest Arkansas. Just thought I'd give Andy a plug for helping us out. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say hey, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And while you're on our site, you might pick up a hat or a shirt. No brooches or pterodactyls yet, but you can find great pricing on our DVDs and a combo deal to save you even more. And don't forget the hats. Have I mentioned the hats? In our initial DVD, Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, we walk you through the extract brewing process step by step, from boiling to bottling. And in Basic Brewing, Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all grain process, from milling your grain to collecting your wort. And you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country here sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it from us online, and I'll put it in a box myself. Well, that's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson, who also designed our logo. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time. So long.